Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI returns to the Vatican following an intense four-day apostolic and state visit to Germany. Ecologists the world over mourn the death of Kenya's Nobel laureate Wangari Maathai, and we shine the light on her legacy. And Father Jim Brown reflects on the very special relationship the Native Americans have with Mother Earth. Pope Benedict XVI has returned to the Vatican after an intense four-day apostolic and state visit to his native Germany. The Pope drew hundreds of thousands of German faithful to events during the various stops of his trip, including a final Mass on Sunday that attracted about 100,000 people to an airfield beside Freiburg's airport. In his parting words before leaving for Rome late Sunday, Benedict wished Germans strength and confidence in their faith, underlining a message repeated throughout the journey. Veronica Skersbrick travelled to Germany to report on Pope Benedict's visit and sent us this last report.
The evening was tinged with sadness. It was a farewell ceremony, but no doubt it was an Auf Wiedersehen until we meet again. And Benedict XVI thanked Germany and its people for the splendid days, for the attention and affection he received. At 84, he had stood up well to his much-wished-for official state visit back home, a gruelling 4 days, complex, charged with events and speeches, as well as being logistically complicated. When he first arrived, he looked moved and began by spelling out why he had come to his homeland. I have come, he said, primarily to meet people and speak about God. And meet people and speak about God he did, plentifully so during this visit, which had as theme, where God is, there is the future. In Berlin, the federal capital, in a keynote address at the Bundestag, he met with Germany's members of parliament, choosing to speak of God and highlighting how this belief represented the foundation of Western progress in law and social justice throughout the centuries.
Vor dem Parlament meines deutschen Vaterlandes.
And although his visit had begun at a disadvantage point, as the media reported widely, aggressiveness soon turned into admiration. His speech at the Reichstag was dubbed by the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung the speech of the century. And even the immensely popular Bild described it as a great speech. Rather curiously, the Spiegel Online soon began speaking of Benedict's blunt new world, remarking how the Pope had not shied away from controversy and how his bluntness had surprised many and could transform the visit into a rousing success. Well, I don't know if I would call it bluntness, but certainly the Germans appreciated the Pope's clarity of thought, his courage in speaking out without mincing his words. Even in the land of Luther, in Erfurt, south of Berlin, when the Pope met with Protestant representatives in a moving historical meeting, during which he walked the very places where Martin Luther was ordained, lived and worked. At a time in history when preparations are underway to mark 5 centuries since the break from Rome in 2017. Even on this occasion, with the separated brethren he knows best, while he may have disappointed some, he did not give in to expectations, but held his ground, shattering hopes that he would come bearing ecumenical gifts.
Dies gilt, wie gesagt, zunächst im persönlichen Lebensbereich jedes Einzelnen.
No, he said on this occasion, there must be no misreading of faith and ecumenism. And in his farewell speech, Benedict XVI remarked how he was profoundly grateful for what he described as fraternal exchange and common prayer.
Für den brüderlichen Austausch und für das gemeinsame Gebet.
But Protestants weren't the only Christians he met. There was a meeting with Orthodox and Oriental Christians as well. significant too for the Pope, who is promoter of dialogue with Christians and non-Christians alike, were, in his words, the meetings with representatives of the Jewish and Muslim communities. And what of more dedicated Catholic moments? Well, there were three masses, one in each of the three cities he visited, in Berlin, Erfurt, and in the more Catholic Freiburg, where on Saturday he pondered as to whether it were not time for change in the Church. It is time once again, he said, for the Church resolutely to set aside her worldliness. That does not mean withdrawing from the world. A Church relieved of the burden of worldliness is in a position, not least through her charitable activities, to mediate the life-giving strength of the Christian faith to those in need, to sufferers and to their carers. There was even time while in Erfurt, which until reunification in 1990 was in eastern Germany, to travel to a Marian shrine in a remote rural area, the Eichsfeld, where Catholics kept the faith alive in time of hardship. In a special way, the Pope praised their patient trust in God's guidance in resisting first the Nazi and then the communist ideology, thus sowing the seed for the future. Reflecting, I thought, not just the motto of this journey, but also the logo, an image in the national colours of Germany showing stylized figures on a path leading upwards towards the future, towards the cross. And right before leaving, the Holy Father encouraged the Church in Germany to pursue with resolute confidence the path of faith which leads people back to their roots, to the heart of the good news of Christ.
Es wird kleine Gemeinschaften von Glaubenden geben, und es gibt sie schon.
It will be small communities of believers, and these already exist, whose enthusiasm spreads within a pluralistic society and makes others curious to seek the light which gives life in abundance. There is nothing more beautiful, he went on to say, than to know Christ and to speak to others of our friendship with him. This experience ultimately gives the certainty that where God is, there is the future. Wherever God is present, there is hope. New and often unexpected horizons open up beyond the present. In this sense, I accompany my thoughts and prayers the path of the Church in Germany. And it was almost dusk when Benedict XVI, who had come here primarily to meet people and speak about God, bade farewell. Farewell, Scott, he said. May God reward you.
The Herr segne Sie alle.
In Germany, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.
Well, thanks there to Veronica for that concluding report. And of course, for all the others she has been sending us throughout Pope Benedict's journey, his third back to his homeland, his 21st abroad. Kenya's Nobel laureate Wangari Maathai has died in Nairobi while undergoing cancer treatment. She was 71 years old. She won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004 for promoting conservation, women's rights and transparent government. She was the first African woman to get the award. She was elected as an MP in 2002 and served as a minister in the Kenyan government. In this 2006 audio clip, she speaks of the relationship between scarce natural resources and global conflict.
Indeed, when we look at the world we live in, and we look at the conflicts and the wars that we fight as we speak, whether they are conflicts in a small way in my country back home, or big conflicts such as we find in the Congo, in Darfur, in many other parts of the world, if you look at them and remove the superficial layers of religion and politics, quite often it's a question of trying to access resources, trying to control those resources, and trying to decide how those resources will be shared. Unfortunately for us, when we leave some people out, when some people feel marginalized, when some people feel like they don't belong, when some people feel like they are not recognized, their voice is not listened to, sooner or later they seek justice. And sometimes they seek justice in a way that precipitates a crisis and a war. So we must change our mindset, because we are so used to thinking about these issues separately and thinking that when we hear some people fighting, we are persuaded to believe that they are fighting because they are different tribes and they hate each other. Or they are fighting because there are too many. Or they are fighting because they are the wrong color. Quite often, it's about resources. And so, because we live on a planet where resources are limited, we must learn to share them, we must learn to manage them, we must learn to live in a system that allows for the greatest space, which, for lack of a better word, we'll call democratic space.
Wangari's unique insight was that the lives of Kenyans, and by extension of people in many other developing countries, would be made better if economic and social progress went hand in hand with environmental protection. One of the legacies she has left us is the Green Belt Movement she founded. It's a movement that reaches across the globe, and it's especially remarkable in that it was also conceived as a source of employment in rural areas and as a way to give new skills to women who regularly came second to men in terms of power, education, nutrition, and much else. I spoke to Francisca de Gasperis, director of the Europe Office of the Green Belt Movement, which, as Francisca explains, Wangari Maathai founded in 1977.
Wangari was an inspirational leader, and her death has come very suddenly, and we are all still in shock, really, to hear that she has passed away last night.
Francisca, can you tell me about the organization she founded, what the main objectives of it are, and how it works?
The Green Belt Movement was founded in 1977, and Wangari started the Green Belt Movement really in response to what the rural women in Kenya were telling her, which was that they weren't getting access to the basic things they needed in life: firewood to cook food, for fuel, clean drinking water. They couldn't feed their children. There were nutritional issues. And as she traveled as a professor at the University of Nairobi around the countryside, she saw a very different landscape from what she'd grown up with 40 years before. Very denuded, the hills, the trees were gone, and the soil was running off into the rivers. And so it was looking at those two issues, both hearing what the women were saying and also looking at what the landscape was looking like, that made Wangari think the problem is that we are destroying the environment. And the people who need it most were the ones who are most rapidly destroying it, the people who live on the front line, the rural poor women. So she started with a very simple project, which was to work with the women to plant trees. And it was really about education and environmental restoration. And that's where it all began.
I understand that she planted some 20 to 30 million trees in Africa. Is that correct?
Actually, you know, it's 47 million in Kenya alone. And other movements that she spearheaded, including the Billion Tree Campaign, which was launched by UNEP in 2007, have planted, I think, over 10 billion. I think it's coming close to 14 billion now. So her inspiration has planted billions of trees around the world.
She was the first African woman, maybe the only African woman, to ever win a Nobel Peace Prize. And during her speech, she said that she hoped her success would spur other women on to a more active role in the community. So she was very much involved in the empowerment of women. Would you say this is one of her main legacies?
Absolutely. One of the quotes that I love most from Wangari's life, although there's many excellent quotes that she's given, which we have up on our website, but one of the ones that I love was when she was in a court case and she was really being ridiculed. You know, Kenyan society in the 70s and 80s really did, because it was under the dictatorship of Daniel Arap Moi, really did try and, you know, cut her down. And she was being ridiculed, and she said at that point, she said, You know, let's talk about the anatomy that really matters in this case, from the neck up. And that's how she looked at the world. She didn't matter if you're a man or a woman. You were a person and you had rights.
Francesca, I've been on your website and I see that the Greenbelt Movement has offices in the United States, in England. I'm speaking to you from London, I think,
yes.
In Kenya. So it really does reach out.
The offices in the UK, which I'm speaking to you from, and the one in the US, were started after the Nobel Peace Prize. And we are really branches of the Greenbelt Movement headquartered in Kenya. And our role is strategic, and we work on advocacy issues. We work on issues such as climate change. We do fundraising and communication. So we are part of the same family. And obviously with Wangari's reach, we did a lot of very close work with her over the years.
This year is the International Year for Forests. Close to your objectives.
Absolutely. It's a very special year for us. And just not long ago, a couple of days ago, we were campaigning against plantations being recognized as forests. It's very important for us that indigenous forests are the forests that are looked after and safeguarded. And we're concerned that that's not being done enough around the world.
Do you know she came to the Vatican and participated, I think, at least in one conference on the environment?
Yes, and it was very important for her to engage with faith-based groups. I know she was absolutely thrilled and honored to be at the Vatican, and she found it a very stimulating conference that she went to with Caritas. I just would like to say that, you know, we are very sad to lose our founder, and it's a real tragedy for her to have passed at this time. She still had a great deal of work to do, but her legacy will live on, and she's got an incredible body of work over her lifetime. And she's given us a hard task to continue and to keep on these issues. The battle is not over yet.
The Green Belt Movement's webpage, as well as the online editions of many international newspapers, are carrying tributes to, memories of, and messages of condolence for Wangari Maathai. You may also want to go onto the Green Belt Movement's webpage to read more about the organisation and what it does, and even how to get personally involved. You can do that at www.greenbeltmovement.org. And now Father Jim Brand stays very much with the theme of this program as he speaks with love and respect of the Native Americans and their very special relationship with Mother Earth.
Hello, this is Father Jim. Last week I was thinking of the world being a common wealth, because God planted a garden in Eden in the East, and there he put us to care for it. And there are many nations in the world who've cared for their mother. And one of the great nations is the Native American. I've been privileged to work with for 8 summers in a reservation in South Dakota. Here is the testimony of Chief Seattle, which you may have heard before, but it bears repeating. He was from the northwest of the United States, and I believe in about the 1830s or 40s wrote a series of letters to the American president. The great chief in Washington sends word he wishes to buy our land. The great chief also sends words of friendship and goodwill. That's kind of him, since we know he has little need of our friendship in return. But we'll consider your offer, for we know that if we don't sell, the white man may come with guns and take our land. How can you buy or sell the sky and the warmth of the land? The idea is strange to us. If we don't own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? Every part of this earth is sacred to my people. Every shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every clearing and humming insect is holy in the memory and experience of my people. The sap, which courses through the trees, carries the memories of the red man. But the white man's dead forget the country of their birth when they go to walk among the stars. But our dead never forget this beautiful earth, for it is the mother of the red man. We're part of the earth, and it is part of us. The perfumed flowers are our sisters. The deer, the horse, the great eagle, these are our brothers. The rocky crests, the juices of the meadows, the body heat of the pony and man, all belong to the same family. So when the great chief in Washington sends word he wishes to buy our land, he asks much of us. The great chief sends word he'll reserve us a place so that we can live comfortably to ourselves. He'll be our father, we'll be his children. So we'll consider your offer to buy our land, but it will not be easy, for this land is sacred to us. This shining water that moves in the streams and rivers isn't just water, but the blood of our ancestors. And if we sell you land, you must remember it's sacred. You must teach your children that it's sacred. And each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lakes tells of events and memories in the life of my people. The water's murmur is the voice of my father's father. The rivers are our brothers. They quench our thirst. The rivers carry our canoes and feed our children. And if we sell you our land, you must remember and teach your children that the rivers are our brothers and yours, and you must henceforth give the rivers the kindness you'd give any brother. The red man's always retreated before the advancing white man as the mist of the mountains runs before the morning sun. But the ashes of our fathers are sacred. Their graves are holy ground. So these hills, these trees, this portion of the earth is consecrated to us. Oh, we know the white man doesn't understand our ways. One portion of the land's the same to him as the next. For he's a stranger, comes in the night, takes from the land whatever he needs. The earth isn't his brother, but his enemy. When he's conquered it, he moves on. He leaves his father's graves behind. He doesn't care. He kidnaps the earth from his children. He doesn't care. His father's graves and his children's birthright are forgotten. He treats his mother, the earth, and his brother, the sky, as things to be bought, plundered, sold like sheep or bright beads. His appetite will devour the earth and leave behind only a desert. I don't know. Our ways are different to your ways. The sight of your cities pains the eyes of the red man. But perhaps it's because the red man's a savage and doesn't understand. There's no quiet place in the white man's cities. No place to hear the unfurling of leaves in spring or the rustle of insects' wings. But perhaps it's because I'm a savage and I don't understand. The clatter only seems to insult the ears. And what is there to life if a man cannot hear the lonely cry of the whippoorwill or the arguments of the frogs around a pond at night? I'm a red man and I don't understand. The Indian prefers the soft sound of the wind darting over the face of a pond and the smell of the wind itself cleansed by a midday rain or scented with the pinyon pine. The air is precious to the red man, for all things share the same breath. The beast, the tree, the man, they all share the same breath. The wind that gave our grandfather his first breath also received his last sigh. And the wind must also give our children the spirit of life. And if we sell you our land, you must keep it apart and sacred. It's a place where even the white man can go to taste the wind that is sweetened by the meadow's flowers. So we'll consider your offer to buy our land. If we decide to accept, I'll make one condition. The white man must treat the beasts of this land as his brothers. I'm a savage and I don't understand any other way. I've seen 1,000 rotting buffaloes on the prairie left by the white man who shot them from a passing train. I'm a savage and I don't understand how the smoking iron horse can be more important than the buffalo that we kill only to stay alive. What is man without the beasts? If all the beasts were gone, men would die of a great loneliness of spirit. For whatever happens to the beasts soon happens to man. All things are connected. Teach your children what we've taught our children, that the earth is our mother. And whatever befalls the earth befalls the sons of the earth. This we know. All things are connected. But we'll consider your offer to go to the reservation you have for my people. We'll live apart and in peace. It matters little where we spend the rest of our days. Our children have seen their fathers humbled in defeat. Our warriors have felt shame, and after defeat they turn their days in idleness and contaminate their bodies with sweet foods and strong drink. It matters little where we pass the rest of our days. They're not many. A few more hours, a few more winters, and none of the children of the great tribes that once lived on this earth, or that roam now in small bands in the woods, will be left to mourn the graves of a people once as powerful and hopeful as yours. Where's the thicket? Gone. Where's the eagle? Gone. And what is it to say goodbye to the swift pony and the hunt? The end of living and the beginning of survival. So we'll consider your offer to buy our land. If we agree, it'll be to secure the reservation you've promised there. Perhaps we may live out our brief days as we wish. But when the last red man has vanished from this earth, and his memory is only the shadow of a cloud moving across the prairie, these shores and forests will still hold the spirits of my people. For they love this earth as the newborn loves its mother's heartbeat. So if we sell you our land, love it as we've loved it. Care for it as we've cared for it. Hold in your mind the memory of the land as it is when you take it. And with all your strength, with all your mind, with all your heart, preserve it for your children and love it as God loves all. One thing we know, our God is the same God. This earth is precious to him. We may be brothers after all. We shall see. Amen.
That's all from the English feature program today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program, Laudetur Jesus Christus.